And no, the European market is so difficult to get into. Europe is a continent, not a country. So don't try navigating that by yourself in the US by coming here. Find a partner here. There's so much opportunity for collaboration and working together.
Hey y'all, welcome back to the Fast Forward Podcast. I am excited for our conversation called World Opportunity, where I'm talking to some people who I adore and respect from around the world who can share with us the various opportunities that are available to develop your career and your business. So today I'm hopping across the pond to Europe. Really excited about this conversation because I had the chance to get to know this lovely person a couple years ago at the emergence of something that is near and dear to my heart, and that is minority business development. I know for a lot of the listeners out there, you might not know that there are similar business advocacy groups that you're probably familiar with seeing in the States, that they exist in other parts of the world too. And that's why I thought it was important for you to meet someone who is not just doing the work, but pioneering and leading the work around this important conversation of global business development and advocacy. So Lucientha, please introduce yourself, excuse me, and let us know something about you.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I still remember the day I met you. It was at my first NMSDC conference in Baltimore, and you got up and you just said something so powerful. I was like, I need to go introduce myself to this woman. So afterwards came and I chatted to you, and I was like, oh, I loved what you had to say, and I told you what I was doing. And then, yeah, it's been what, almost two years or so.
Yes.
So I'm glad we
time
connected.
Time is just like, I don't know, it's like inverted. 2 years feels like 10 years, feels like 2 months. It's going fast and slow at the same time. It's so weird.
So let me introduce myself. Again, thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm excited to share what we're doing in Europe. My name is Lucientha Naidu. I'm the Managing Director for the European Supplier Diversity Program based here in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And yes, they have. We are the newest advocacy group around the world. We're about 19 months old in terms of operations in Europe. A little bit about myself. So I am proudly South African. I grew up during apartheid South Africa, which actually stems where my passion and my purpose comes from. Because growing up during that kind of oppression, I was like, I have this incredible lived experience. How do I do something that's impactful in the world? So I did go on. By dreaming big, I got out and wanting to see the world. I had a very international career. I worked at Unilever for about 15 years in finance and supply chain. And during COVID, I think everyone gets reflective. And I was like, okay, how do I want to live my life with intention and do something impactful? So I quit my job. And literally my last week, I came across this amazing networking session talking about supplier diversity and starting something in Europe. And yeah, 2 years, 2.5 years later, here I am leading the organization, from setting it up as a foundation, a nonprofit here in the Netherlands. And we now have a database of about 500 ethnic minority suppliers in the EU.
That is amazing. To see the growth, to me, that indicates the need. Right. So when people latch on and there are so many early adopters, that lets you know that it was something that folks not only needed, but also wanted to see. And the thing about all advocacy groups, and I think this is an important distinction to make, is that because folks have the perception that it's almost like the mob or the mafia, where we're like strong arming companies to work with us. No, it is designed to create community. It is designed to create education hubs for folks to learn about how to launch and grow their businesses. And it's also an opportunity for visibility. And I think that's the part that people don't get a lot of times about business advocacy, is that a lot of times the access is simply visibility. Folks might not even know that you're there or be able to see you, because we may not always be positioned in the same social networks for a lot of large companies, or in the same places, because maybe we don't live in the same neighborhoods, even sometimes the same towns. And so folks don't see us. And as a result of not seeing us, they don't see our businesses. So being able to be a part of networks like ESDP and other organizations, like for me on this side of the world, it's NMSDC and WeBank, that gives us a chance to be seen. We still have to build our businesses. We still have to operate in integrity and excellence. We still have to have a marketable product and service. All the same things that all business owners have to do, except now we're not building that in vain or in a vacuum. We're building it to be seen in the market. And that is the difference maker. I just wanted to just throw that out there first. I'm like, that's my pitch.
And that's what we're doing, right? It's equity. It's just giving everyone a fair chance because not everyone has that network you're talking about. It's how do we then create that so everyone has access to equal opportunities, equity, and education is my passion. So I can even talk about that more. It's how do we have giving access to education, developing those suppliers. So when they are going for that RFP and pitching, they are having all the tools, all the resources to get them that RFP.
Yes, I love that. And I also want to make a note, because when you talked about your own history, the merger of having such a fortunate career, and I'm going to explain why I said fortunate in a second, but then also the lived experience of growing up in the extremes of difference and discrimination cannot be overstated. Because, and I've experienced very similar. So growing up, you know, in a segregated region in Detroit. So if anybody who's going to end up watching this knows anything about Detroit, Detroit is predominantly Black, but it is deeply segregated in the Metro Detroit region. Its racial, you know, history and turmoil has been well documented over many years. And I remember when I studied abroad in South Africa, that was my second study abroad experience.
How was that?
Yes, I was in Durban for a month.
Durban.
Yes, yes. I was going to ask, I was like, I wonder, is she from Durban? And I remember going to South Africa, and as a part, we each got to pick our own research projects, but as a part of that experience, we had to learn about the history of apartheid so that in our research, we could have context for what we were seeing. And I remember it as I was conducting research and then learning the history, it sounded so familiar to me because I had grown up experiencing some of those differences, seeing some of those differences, even in college, at undergrad, seeing that. And it changes you. You know, Lucinta, you're absolutely right. Like, you can't leave those types of extreme circumstances and not be impacted. So then to come out of such extreme circumstances, whether or not you were the recipient of the discrimination, even just growing up in the environment changes you. Then to go work in these huge corporations where you were experiencing an incredible amount of privilege just by virtue of being an employee, right? So now you are living these experiences where you are probably making more money, right, than most of the folks who are around you or that you may have grown up around. You're traveling the world. You're doing all these things. There is a level of social respect and status that you get, and it can be unnerving. And so I think a part of what it sounds like our shared advocacy is based in is the fact that, like, we know both sides. I know what it is like to grow up and be othered, but then I also know what it is like to be the prized social person just by virtue of saying, I have this badge to work for this company. And the polarization of those experiences, I think it has caused a lot of us to move into advocacy, not just because we want to put more people in privilege, but because we actually want to transform the systems that create these very different experiences of privilege and marginalization.
Wow, you put that so eloquently. I mean, I'm still even closer to you now, knowing that you've been to my hometown and you've had the same experiences. I didn't know about that you grew up in Detroit. And that's what it is. It was, people don't realize that things like apartheid and your segregation happened in the 90s. I mean,
yes. Yes. Folks think it was like in 1817. I'm like, no, like my uncle got some stories, right? Like, you know?
Because everyone's like, how old are you? Because that happened in the 60s. I was like, no, 1994 was when Mandela became president.
Yes.
You know, I remember that's when my life changed like that. Because my parents, people who don't know much about apartheid, but based on your skin color, it depended on how what kind of life you lived, what education you had, the darker skin, the lower skills you allowed.
Yes.
Dad is one of the smartest people I knew, but he wasn't allowed to have this tertiary education. My brother and I, the first generation to go to university. And it not was like, oh, it was handed to you. I think I worked from the age of 6 years old because my dad was like, one day things are going to change and you're gonna grab all those opportunities with both hands. So we worked our asses off. Sorry, I said the word.
No, you're fine. This is an adult podcast. You're good.
But it was from my, people don't realize it. I didn't have a normal child. I mean, yes, I had a great childhood play and stuff, but it was academics because you're gonna change. Things are gonna change and you're gonna grab those. You're gonna have a different life to what we had. And I didn't understand it at the time until I experienced this privilege you talked about. I was like, from one day to the next, I was taken from my ethnicity was Indian, and you know how it is. You're actually separated by the type of ethnicity. And then next, one day to the next, I was put to a Model C school, which is a former white school. And it blew my mind that I was sitting in a class of like 40 kids sharing textbooks, like books. And then I would go to the school being probably one of three non-white kids in my class. And I was like, wait, you get not only just your own textbooks, but they have a swimming pool. They have tennis courts. They have space. Hello. And this is like 10 minutes from my house. How are we living in the same
It's a different place, world. You know? Yes. I had an experience like that because I was a band kid. And so in Michigan, you have like band and orchestra festivals, but they would host them at different schools. And when we would go, I mean, we would almost be in tears because we had a world-class band. Now, mind you, I'm sorry. Let me make this clarification. I went to the top high school in Detroit Public Schools. Like to this day, it is number one. It is ranked around the country, produces politicians, business owners, like the elites of the city went to this school, right? And we still were like wearing coats in the classroom because the heat didn't half work, like, you know, selling chicken dinners to make sure we could pay for this because the school system's budget was right. So we would go to these other, you know, to these festivals at other schools. And mind you, we're wearing like old uniforms that are probably like 10 years old. You got to rent it every year from the little like closet where they keep all the stuff hoping it fit. And they would have a band room that looked like a concert hall. I mean, multiple levels. Cause we in this little cramped classroom. So you got to like sit up to make sure you could see over the such and such player because they taller. And they had like the levels and state-of-the-art instruments and state-of-the-art sounds and acoustics. And we were like, what? Looking at their gyms, their cafeterias, and we couldn't believe it. And this was like you said, 10, 15 minutes from the city of Detroit. And that was the beginning, I think, for a lot of us to realize that while we were at the top of a hierarchy in our city, there is a whole other level of privilege that you can experience. And then we understood exactly what your parents told you, because they would tell us, you are the best, but the goal is for you to be the best in your integrity. Reach behind and help others. Create ways for, like, and we would be like, okay, that's fine. Yeah, y'all keep saying. But when we started having those experiences in high school, at the top of college, we get it now. And even now to this day, like I'll bump into alums or folks I went to school with in different cities who sit and had lunch or whatever. And they're like, I can't believe like that we were making it, even though clearly the money was not there. Like that's how we knew our teachers loved us, because they would push for us to go to other countries to study or sing or play or whatever. Like we didn't know. And to your point, yeah, you do have those watershed moments where your life fundamentally changes. And then you're like, okay, now what am I going to do with this gift of privilege that I've been given? Because I can either sit in it and sit like, you know, it's a cartoon that was here in the States called Darkwing Duck. And so we could sit there like Scrooge McDuck, you know, just like counting all our little coins and stuff. Or we could say, hey, I want others to experience the stabilization that I've been able to see, where it's like, I know that I'll be able to pay my rent. I know I'll be able to clear a mortgage. I know that I have a network of access that I can ask someone to make an introduction to me because I've built that. How can I make that for other people? And I think that to me, that's when I knew I made it, when my heart matched my ability to do that for other folks.
I love that. I really do. And yeah, we have this lived experience, and I was like, what can I do with this? You know, I was, even though I worked at corporate for almost 15 years and I made it to director level, but I was always driving the DEI activities on the side. And I got to a point where I'm like, my day job was demanding. I was back pre-COVID, 3 countries in a week in Europe. And I was still leading the ERG for women and trying to push things on intersectionality. And I was always hitting this, like, the roof on it. And straight, I was like, okay, I've like done all I can here now. But I am getting my energy from the day is coming from this piece of work. So maybe I should go and do this full time. Yes. And when I told this to like friends and family, like, you're crazy. What are you doing? You're throwing away your career. And it was the hardest thing for me was actually go tell my family, because they sacrificed so much for me. And it's not like they're not proud of what I'm doing now, but like my dad worked so much to make sure that we had this better life. But now I'm at this point where I'm defining what this better life is for me and how can I make the lives of others also better.
I'm so happy you brought up that pull and the tension between honoring family legacy and honoring social and societal legacy. Because for a lot of us who do this work, who are first generation entrepreneurs, first generation, you know, middle class or affluent, there is that pull, because the image that our families had of what success looked like, not only were we working toward that, but it was also our opportunity to see and know what belonging felt like. So we have a place in the family because we are working toward that goal. When we choose a new goal, then it's like, okay, well, where is my belonging in the family? Because it's like Lucientha, the smart one. Lucientha is the executive at da-da-da. And you get a lot of identity from that. You get a ton of identity from saying that. Uh-huh. And yes, like what happens when that identity shifts and you have to educate your family on the importance or value of having pride in this new identity too, not just the other one?
Exactly. And it took me, I think, 3 years to actually shift out and be like, because I always had this thought and I was like, but when COVID happened, I was like, no, when we emerge from this, I need to do something different. But I think honestly, like, it took me that long to make the shift, because it's risky, right? And I also felt like, in a way, oh my God, am I letting people down? I always have this thing letting people down. So when I had the courage to tell them, I was like, I took a sabbatical and I traveled for a while and I came out and I was like, no, now I'm certain this is what I'm going to do. So I told them. And actually what surprised me was they were more supportive than I expected. And I was like, oh, okay. This is a good feeling. They're like, we trust you. You do what's best for you, you know. So that was really great. And even though I didn't know what I was doing next, and when I started this up, they know I'm an advocate at heart.
Yes.
And yeah, it's you know, people, I had some of my, not mentors, but my advisors who said, like, you're throwing away your career. And I'm like, why does it always have to be like this? Can it not just be the next chapter? And this is what I do. And I don't know what I will do next, but this is what I'm doing right now. And this is what, you've seen the journey that we've had. It isn't easy. I honestly thought, okay, coming, moving away from my corporate role, let's have a bit of a breather. No, this is not the case.
No.
It's tested my resilience like you wouldn't believe, especially this last 8 months.
So that's what I was going to ask, because obviously supplier diversity and supplier enablement has changed dramatically over the last couple years, but especially this year. You know, can you share the most impactful changes and trends that you've noticed?
So I think where we are, and maybe it's beneficial for us, is that we're so early on the journey here. And I say the EU, because the UK is more advanced on it. I think in the US it started almost 50 years ago, UK 20 years ago. And here the topic of supply inclusion, supply diversity is fresh. I mean, even when I was saying earlier, it was like when we talk about diversity here, it's automatically gender diversity.
Yes.
If we talk intersectionality, people are like, intersection, what? You know, talking about race and ethnicity is very sensitive, very, very sensitive. Even collecting data is it's almost impossible because of regulations here. So in a way, yes, I feel like the US has led the way and you guys are going through so much changes, which is impacting us in Europe. But at the same time, we were still sort of defining what is in Europe. I think where we've progressed is before we just had two other advocacy groups. Now there's us. And the challenges we face, I mean, I think we're definitely opening up for more small business engagement. You see things in terms of like social, there's more drive for social value, for ESG, there's different government regulations to help small businesses to grow. What I like about in the Netherlands, you'll see like one of my favorite topics, payment terms for small businesses is 30 days here. I mean, versus 90 days, we'll take the 30 days. I would like it to reduce even further, but that's some progress here. And I see then, like, you know, because we were, ESDP was born after Black Lives Matters, and obviously there was a push. And now you see who truly stands by the values. So there is still support for the advocacy groups here. I was telling you earlier, we had an event in Paris, and doing this kind of work in France is hard. I joke around sometimes, I think people throw tomatoes at me. But we had a packed room in the middle of Paris with 100 people, which is big for us, talking about these amazing topics, having Coca-Cola, Fernando coming over from the US, EY there, CBRE, these are the companies are like, nope, we're going to still do this. And as tiring as it was, when I have events like that with my team, I'm like, it makes it all worth it. And I think the biggest shift is obviously immigration has grown. So the need for what we're doing is there. But at the same time, you see the rise of the far right.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing in the US.
Yes, it's happening worldwide. You
definitely feel the shift here. But yeah, it just makes the need for what we are doing even more important. And this is where I say the resilience is tested, because things, you see what's happening in Germany, the Netherlands, we have a far-right government which collapsed, and now we have elections coming up in October.
I'm so happy that you brought up is three aspects which tie into intersectionality, actually, because place matters, and not just place where the work is taking place, but the places where partners originate. So, of course, you know, I'm based in Atlanta, home of Coca-Cola. Well, if you look at the demographics of Coca-Cola's hometown, right, or, you know, base town, yeah, they probably would stand behind the work because that reflects where their headquarters is already located, right? And you'll see similar commitments from companies where they're either home base or largest employee bases or largest customer bases are based. If they are diverse, they're probably going to hold on to diversity because it's in their best interest. And I think that that's the piece that gets lost sometimes in supplier diversity conversations, because folks assume that it's just like rabbit out of the hat, we're going to support today and then tomorrow we're not. No, companies have whole departments. And believe me, I done worked in diversity at some large companies, doing this work a long time. I know who's in the room because I've been in the room about where, well, we're launching this new product in da-da-da city or da-da-da country. We can't afford to pull out of this program. And I bring that up as a point because particularly as a small business owner, and I know this is controversial, but you can't always afford to care why somebody is supporting you. I know that sounds crazy. I know that's probably like, it's a fight because you want people to support you for altruism, but there are going to be some companies that are just in it for the money. There's going to be some companies that are just in it because they want such and such award from this group. And guess what? We'll take that too. It doesn't mean that you do shady business. It doesn't mean that you sell your soul, but it means that you recognize that companies are made up of many different stakeholders and everybody is not in it for self-actualization reasons. I have this motivation matrix that I created or grid, and it started out of my DEI trainings because when I would go and do DEI consulting in companies, folks would say, well, we want people to care about folks' lives. And I was like, no, that's caring about security. Some people only care about prestige. Like if they can't get public back pats for helping out minorities or women, they're not going to get involved. So you have to include some reward for that person because guess what? They're the VP of da-da-da department. And that same mindset is also applicable to business development and supplier diversity. Some people are only in it because I know if I market to that community, we gonna make millions of dollars. Okay, like, you know what I mean? Like, we can't expect everybody to just do things for the heart of it. That's just not realistic. Because to be honest, we don't always just do everything we do for the heart of it, right? Like, just like you and I are driven by the desire to see a different world than when we grew up, that is just as valid as the person who is like, I always dreamed of getting an award. All right, fine. We'll work with that. Like, I'll take that today because this is a chess move to get us further along this larger journey that needs to take place.
Listen, I'll take any support I can get, no matter how it's packaged. Obviously, I wanted to come in a more altruistic way. And listen, those are the people that are standing by our side right now. And
yep.
It's true about people. I put them in boxes, you know, in like numbers of five. There's the four fives who I think, you know, they're going to be your advocate. The three, they're borderline. They're going to swing. They just need a little nudge. The two, you need a bit of education and awareness. And not everyone, let's face it, I'm naturally an empathetic person. Not everyone is. How do you then get them? And I found like there's so much power in storytelling. Not everyone has had that same lived experience, so it's hard for them to understand. And like you wouldn't believe it, but I only started sharing my personal story about 3 years ago publicly because it's still so deep rooted. You know, we didn't go into the deep conversations, but one day over coffee or cocktail, I mean, you've also experienced what Durban is like. I had to shift that anger into something positive, that pain. And can't assume now somebody who hasn't gone through that is just going to get it like that. So I will then invest time in getting that person on the why. I'll like come to events and they leave there and they realize, because a lot of it is fear of like then also being othered. I'm like, see what a welcoming environment is, how engaged, and no one talks about putting in like in boxes, and they leave there and they're like, I like this. Okay, I'll join. Some people are like, it's not for me, it's fine. And then there's the ones which I'm like, I'm not gonna even waste my energy on.
That's the one fact. Yeah. I'm so happy you said that. I love that the four fives, because those are the people who we spend so much energy, time, and just like resources trying to pull to. They're never gonna buy into it. There are some people who will never support supplier diversity. And a lot of those people, if you think about it, they were raised and, dare I say, groomed to believe that success is a pie. And if you are taking anything bigger than a sliver, you're taking my pie, instead of seeing No, it's actually a whole bakery. And there are more ingredients in
exactly.
the back. So it's
how
like,
how do we bake a bigger pie?
Yes. Like, and guess what? Even if you don't see your chocolate croissant, just ask them because they got some more cooling in the back. Like, that's just what you see today. But we haven't been raised in that type of economic mindset. It is very much, you are taking something that inherently belongs to me. And that's the problem.
Exactly. And it's like, how do we, and what's wrong with a little competition? If you know you're good at what you're doing, what you're scared of?
There we go. I think, and so that leads to my next question, which is, so as founders and entrepreneurs from underrepresented groups, whether that's minorities, by gender, by sexual orientation, by any of the identity dimensions, how can we be better self-advocates? Because again, we are coming into environments where there are folks who are assuming that we're taking something from them by simply entering into the competitive business market. So how can we be better self-advocates as we enter that market to compete?
I think also, you know, that the term that I'm going to say is Ubuntu. If you're familiar with South Africa, I am because we are, which is the philosophy that humanity is based on the plural and not the singular. And that is instilled in my DNA. It's the way I lead ESDP is about community. Listen, we need to be helping each other and also your self-advocacy. And this is what I've learned also on my journey is like, I think if anyone to ask me what are you most proud of in with ESDP, and it's the community we've built. You know, it's not just about, oh, this is why we have this database. But when you come to our events, it's that feeling that you leave with. And it's about helping each other. That's the most important thing. It's how do you collaborate with each other? And also, I think what we've done in terms of education, and especially as woman of color, we all have our, everyone has imposter syndrome. I think those with our experience, it's even stronger. And it's probably not talked about. I don't know how it is in the US here. I feel like it's not talked about enough is how do you overcome that? I have it too. And we've even done trainings with our academy, the Inclusive Procurement Academy, on overcoming imposter syndrome. And people don't realize they have imposter syndrome. So it's about helping. I always believe when you help each other, things also come your way. And how do you also then strongly believe in what you're doing and that you're the best out there? And I see that a lot with our businesses, like, oh, they're better. And I had the same mindset when I came to Europe. I was like, oh, I got schooled in South Africa. People would say, and you know, I came here knowing nobody. I just got offered the job. You want to move to Switzerland? I'm like, sure. Never been to Europe before. I just moved. And I didn't realize how hard it would be without a network. Because even though I came as a senior manager, people were like, oh, you don't have an MBA from this school? Okay. But then I realized very quickly, I was like, I'm damn good at what I'm doing. I don't need a piece of paper over there from this university. And then I was like, oh, okay. And this is why it's also so important for me to build this network in ESDP. Yeah. So people don't always have to feel that way. Yes. And we are equipping our suppliers to, when they go into that RFP, as I said, is that they know they're the best. I've been on the other side of corporates. This is not charity. No one's going to be like, I'm going to work with this business. So, you know, no, at the end of the day, it's profit.
Yes.
ESDP is just giving access to more innovative and creative businesses. And I wish businesses had them and all that self-belief to realize how good they are. And this is the visibility we're giving with the ESDP. So I know I went a little around the question.
Because I think you brought up a really good point, which is that it starts with how you feel about yourself, and it starts with committing to forming or joining networks that reinforce that feeling of belonging, but also excellence. Entrepreneurship is super isolating. It's so isolating to think that you're running this thing that may have never existed before, that you may be the first person in your family. And feelings do matter. Feelings matter a lot. And how we are able to first feel about ourselves is the beginning of how we choose to show up in the marketplace. And us showing up as feeling like we have something that is worth selling, feeling like we have something that is worth believing in and sticking with, that is the beginning of growth. And like you said, then committed to being a part of those networks where other people feel like that about themselves and us too. I love that. Okay, final question. Because on that note of feeling, you know, I think sometimes I take for granted that I know people around the world, which is why I wanted to do this topic. I wanted to know, how can we, meaning me and my other American counterparts, how can we support our European counterparts in this push and this mission of business development for all of us? How can we show up to create a stronger supply chain globally for each other?
Two things I was thinking about, and this has been on my mind for a long time, because whenever I come for a conference in the US, I'm always wowed by the scale of the business and the successes, like the Nina Vankas of the world. And I'm sure she's had her immense struggles. It started somewhere, but she's built this empire. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our businesses here in Europe are smaller and starting up. I would love to do some sort of like mentoring program when they hear you guys speak and the challenges you've overcome. And because it's that again, that power of storytelling and sharing and, you know, supporting each other. Like, no, you got this, you know, it's challenging, but you'll get there. And another way is, you know, the European market is so difficult to get into. We have so many regulations. And in the US, I keep telling people, Europe
is
a continent.
Yes, I can testify to that.
Europe is a continent, not a country. So even though, like, even with us, we have to check EU law, country law, you know, there's regulations, labor laws are intense here. So don't try navigating that by yourself in the US by coming here. Find a partner here. There's so much opportunity for collaboration and working together where European businesses can learn from, you know, this mindset in the US, like this can-do attitude, like we're going to make it work. And the businesses in Europe can help you navigate the difficult red tape in Europe, you know, and grow together. I see it as a win-win.
I love that. I love that so much. We definitely have to continue this conversation because I got some ideas brewing, my friend. So yes, let's chat. That's all I can say about that. Lucientha, thank you so much for this conversation. I'm going to be chewing on a lot of this for so long. And I hope that everyone who gets a chance to see this is able to pull so many nuggets, not just from your work and what you've noticed as a professional, but also your personal story, because I know so many of us can see ourselves in you. So thank you so much for being here. Of course, y'all be sure to drop a comment. What stood out to you? What supports do you need as a minority business owner, whether you're in Europe, the United States, or another part of the world? And how can we support you? Thank you again, Lucientha. Thanks, y'all, for tuning in. Of course, be sure to like, share, and subscribe. And I will catch y'all in the next one. Bye.